Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. Nicholas Cage's Bel Air estate price drops from $35 million to $17.5 million. Still no offers. One of the highest paid actors in Hollywood, Nicolas Cage, can't seem to catch a break. Even after slashing the price of his Bel Air estate from $35 million to $17.5 million, and then to a minimum bid of $10.4 million, still no one bid came in on the property during its foreclosure auction last week, which was reported to last all of 60 seconds. According to a story in the LA Times, Cage's mansion includes 9 bathrooms, 6 bedrooms, an Olympic-sized pool, a custom wine cellar, and a 35-seat home theater. Cage borrowed against his home's equity during the boom years, taking out a total of 6 loans against the house, totaling more than $18 million, but with no bidders, the lender that foreclosed on the property still owns it, and I suppose plans to take a bath in each of the home's 9 bathrooms. So, the bank wouldn't even modify a loan for Nick Cage? I wonder if they lost his paperwork 6 times, then got him to make a bunch of trial payments before they foreclosed, or whether it's true that Hollywood stars get special treatment and go straight to foreclosure without the rest of the nonsense that the American people are discovering with the foreclosure modifications supposedly being offered to them. And from an editorial in the New York Times, fighting foreclosures. From the start, the central concern about President Obama's anti-foreclosure effort has been that it would postpone foreclosures but ultimately not prevent enough to ease the economic strain from mass defaults. That concern seems increasingly justified. In the first quarter of 2010, there were 930,000 foreclosure filings, an increase of 7% from the previous quarter and 16% from the first 3 months of 2009, according to recent data from RealtyTrack, an online marketer of foreclosed properties. The surge seems to indicate that homes that were in the foreclosure pipeline are now being lost for good. The administration's figures are not encouraging either. The Treasury recently reported that as of March, nearly 228,000 troubled loans qualified under the Obama plan for long-term payment reductions. Another 108,000 long-term modifications were pending. That's up from February, but still far behind the need. Currently, some 6 million borrowers are more than 60 days delinquent. 3 oversight groups have issued reports in the past month criticizing the administration's effort and predicting that it would fall far short of its goal of helping 4 million borrowers by the end of 2012. And last week, officials from J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo told a congressional panel that they were not inclined to fully embrace the administration's latest foreclosure prevention plan. announced in late March, it calls for lenders to modify troubled mortgages by cutting the loan principal, which restores some equity to borrowers while lowering the payment. The bankers were unpersuasive. They generally objected to large-scale principal reductions, even though the administration's plan applies narrowly to borrowers who are deeply indebted and meet various other criteria. The testimony was more proof that relying on lenders to voluntarily rework troubled loans is not working. The hearing investigated a specific obstacle to widespread modifications. Investors, including pension funds and mutual funds, often hold the first mortgages. Investors reasonably believe that second liens should be reduced before the primary mortgage is modified, but banks balk at that because it would prompt write-offs they don't want. Some investors, notably the powerhouse group BlackRock, have called for a special bankruptcy process to resolve the standoff. The court would seek to reduce bankrupt borrowers' total debt to affordable levels, starting with unsecured debt like credit cards, then undersecured debt like second mortgages, and then, if necessary, the primary mortgage debt. We have long called for using bankruptcy court to help resolve the foreclosure crisis. A big advantage of bankruptcy over government-subsidized modifications is that bankruptcy is a difficult process that does not entice anyone to purposely default in order to get better payment terms. Banks have argued for the status quo, in which bankruptcy judges are not allowed to modify the terms of primary mortgages, and they have prevailed in Congress and apparently within the administration. The result is an ongoing foreclosure crisis. It is time to revive the fight to open the courthouse door to bankrupt homeowners. And that was from an article in the New York Times editorial section by attorney Chris Mills from New York, who is a bankruptcy specialist. And from Jim Puzanghera at the LA Times, he said Washington Mutual Examiner was ridiculed, called housing bubble boy. The regulators did little to halt reckless practices at Washington Mutual. Federal banking examiners found serious problems at Washington Mutual Bank at least 5 years before its 2008 collapse, but their supervisors showed little concern. During those 5 years, examiners constantly warned of less than satisfactory loan underwriting, the horrible performance of its subprime-backed mortgage securities, and the failure of WaMu executives and federal regulatory supervisors to do much about it. One examiner said he was derided by colleagues as the housing bubble boy for his gloom and doom predictions for some risky loans, and another complained that critics of subprime loans were called Chicken Little. Former Office of Thrift Supervision Director John Reich, who served from 2005 to 2009, referred to WaMu Chief Executive Kerry Killinger as my largest constituent in a 2007 email. That attitude pervaded the upper levels of the agency. Once again, the field examiners did their job, but their efforts were ridiculed. I was asked by a reporter a couple of years ago who was to blame for the housing bubble, and I said the list is long, but it starts with the regulators. And that's from an article by Jim Puzanghera at the LA Times, concluding that regulators did little to halt reckless practices at Washington Mutual. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And for some weeks now, we've been looking at The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke, which is a book by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi, her daughter, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. And I start with a credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi. I highly recommend their books, all your worth and the two income trap. And you can also revisit all of the shows at www.kruufm.com in the archives under Life and Debt to get a full education on all the issues we have discussed regarding debt. The topic I was discussing last week is the single parent family trying to get out of the two income trap with a specific focus on women. There is one solution that I discussed that is set forth by nearly every politician, women's group, and angry mother: make the father pay more for the children, who of course are normally living with the mom. The argument has plenty of emotional appeal. It resonates with some of our most basic values: equity between men and women, following through on commitments, and protecting our children. It also fits with our common sense. After all, everyone knows some unfortunate woman who is having a dreadful time making ends meet since she got stiffed by her ex. And we have all heard news reports about the men who are absconding without making their payments. The experts of a generation ago, and even today, predicted with such confidence that better child support enforcement would ensure financial security for single mothers. But does increasing child support really hold the key to survival for millions of middle-class single mothers? Do ex-husbands hold the untapped wealth that single mothers need for financial security, and all that remains is to seek it out? These are basic questions posed by Professor Warren. America has spent a generation hunting down the devious deadbeat dad, but single mothers are in more trouble than ever, according to the statistics she found. It doesn't come through in most news reports, but the overwhelming majority of middle-class fathers today are paying the support they owe. According to the surveys, non-resident fathers who earned more than $30,000 a year reported that they were paying more than 95% of their court-ordered support for children. Of course, this statistic may be somewhat distorted by men who overestimate their own payments. Single mothers would usually report receiving less than fathers report paying. But another survey of single mothers found similar results. Among fathers who are steadily employed, which includes a number of men who work for low wages, 80% of their ex-wives reported receiving full payment. These numbers stand as a reminder that there is not much left to collect. Additional enforcement of child support can provide only limited help to struggling middle-class women with children. And what about the dads who don't pay? About two-thirds of these men do not pay because they are not legally required to pay. They have not had paternity established, or they are separated but not yet divorced. And what about those who have children support orders in place but don't pay what they owe, the infamous deadbeat dads? It turns out that the non-payers are far more likely to have low incomes and to live in poverty. According to one estimate, 6 out of 10 non-resident fathers who fail to pay child support either have low incomes, are substance abusers, or have outstanding obligations to support new children. Another study found that most non-payers had recently been unemployed. These guys may be down on their luck, irresponsible, or just plain mean, but the stone-cold reality is that unemployment, poverty-level wages, drug addiction, and additional kids to provide for make it far more difficult for these men to come up with regular support payments. And no amount of legal pressure will change that. Some activists argue that women are in financial trouble because, as Lenore Weitzman observed, current child support awards are too low and place a disproportionate financial burden on mothers. According to this line of thinking, judges should demand more money from men in the beginning, making child support awards substantially larger. Again, these arguments are highly charged. Women's groups point to the fact that custodial mothers are far more likely to end up in poverty than their ex-husbands, and increasing child support awards is one way to ensure more equitable living standards for kids. Fathers groups, for their part, argue that child support guidelines are already too rigid because they ignore a man's obligations, such as those to support a new family, and changes in his ex-wife's income, such as earnings from her new husband. Support orders also disregard changes to a father's income. According to one study of men who experienced a sharp drop in earnings, only 4% were able to persuade the courts to lower their child support payments. In either case, activists on behalf of single mothers are probably right in their basic conclusion. Privation could be spread more evenly between men and women. Child support guidelines could be changed to ensure that no man would have a penny more discretionary income than his ex-wife does, and that if one ex-spouse suffers, so does the other. Several family law reformers have embraced what we call the share the pain model, whose ultimate goal is for all family members to emerge from a marital breakdown with roughly equal standards of living, so that no one, specifically children and those who care for them, suffer disproportionately from the failure of a marriage. According to this approach, if the mother and children live at twice the poverty rate, then so should the ex-husband. Professor Warren responds, "Fair enough. But the critical question is, how far would these changes get today's single mother? Would the share the pain model lift single mothers and their children out of their financial hole? A typical example would show that the husband is already paying more than the share the pain model would call for, and the wife lives at more than 2 times the poverty level, whereas the ex-husband, after paying child support to his ex-wife, scrapes by at less than 2 times the poverty level. So we use this measure, and the ex-wife and kids are doing much better than the ex-husband, yet what we discover is that the ex-wife is still bankrupt. Professor Warren investigates further what happens to the typical dual-income couple if they get divorced using the share the pain approach. And the example is referring to typical middle-class people. The husband typically would be required to pay the ex-wife roughly 1/2 to his take-home pay. Using the share the pain approach, the wife's situation would be undeniably better than under the current guidelines being used, because her support checks would increase considerably. But if she wanted to keep the home, the car, the daycare, and the health insurance, she would still face a 54% drop in discretionary income, even if the ex-husband paid every penny. Still, we're looking at the share the pain approach. This is better than the 86% drop she would experience under the current system. So the share the pain model might appeal to our sense of fairness, and it might even be the right response to a bad situation. But even such a drastic change to the child support guidelines is no panacea for middle-class single mothers and no guarantee of her financial survival. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I was just talking about the share the pain approach to try to help single moms balance their standard of living with that of the ex-husband. And we see that in some cases it could work. However, it is still no guarantee of her financial survival. But let's go the next step. What if dad shares custody of the kids? As we know from our divorce attorney colleagues, this is an increasingly likely outcome. Approximately 1 out of 6 divorcing couples are awarded joint custody now. Many fathers' rights groups support the trend, arguing that joint custody is in the best interest of the children and fosters a meaningful relationship with both of their parents. But what about the financial impact of these arrangements? Joint custody would free mom from the overwhelming burden of bearing sole responsibility for all the day-to-day childcare requirements, but the overall impact on her financial well-being is more complex. Consider housing. Often when the couple splits up, the husband avoids bankruptcy court by finding the cheapest efficiency apartment he could find. Now, if he needed to find a home suitable for himself and the children, preferably near their school, he normally would have no prayer of making ends meet or making support payments to his ex-wife. Joint custody effectively doubles the family's housing expenses without creating any new income to cover the costs. Cars, furniture, clothing, utilities. There are no savings, but substantial opportunities to increase costs when both parents provide half-time homes for their children. Of course, there are very valuable emotional and psychological benefits from the joint custody. However, when we look at the finances, there's also another serious financial side effect on the woman. Joint custody may mean less child support. With both parents providing a home for their children, courts are less inclined to order that child support flow in a single predetermined direction from dad to mom. One study found that judges are 3 times more likely to order no child support under a joint custody case than a case where the mother is awarded sole custody. Joint custody may be the best way to involve fathers in their children's lives, but it is no financial promised land for either single parent. Professor Warren says that divorced fathers have become a kind of mythic solution. Anyone concerned about the financial distress of single mothers simply joins in the rallying cry to make dads pay more. But she offers sobering data. There is substantial evidence that millions of fathers are already struggling to make their current payments and may not be able to pay more, regardless of what the courts order. Only 46% of divorced fathers own their own homes, a rate that is about half that of married fathers generally. Divorced fathers are also less likely to own a car. Indeed, 1 out of 3 unmarried, non-resident fathers cannot even maintain their own household and live with their parents or other extended family. Even more telling, Professor Warren's data indicates that unmarried mothers aren't the only ones filing for bankruptcy in record numbers. Divorced dads are in just about as much trouble. She estimates that more than 160,000 men with child support and alimony obligations will end up in bankruptcy each year. This means that fathers who owe child support are more than 3 times more likely to file for bankruptcy than single men who don't owe support. Indeed, non-resident fathers with child support obligations are the only group that approaches single mothers in their extraordinarily high level of financial distress. These men are caught in the same financial maelstrom as their ex-wives. They must come up with money for an apartment and all the accoutrements of their newly single lives, not to mention thousands of dollars in legal fees, but they too have nothing in savings to cover these costs. Like their soon-to-be ex-wives, many turn to debt to get through the months following the divorce. Soon, they're a few thousand dollars in the hole, and bankruptcy may be just around the corner. Many people are brought up with the concept that you sign your name, you pay your bills, period. But as the mountain of debt builds for necessities, not for anything extraordinary not for wants, but for downright bare necessities, people turn to the law to help them out. And that is what bankruptcy does for these people. Also, it should be noted that men do not file for bankruptcy as a way of ducking out of their support payments. That's an obligation, and bankruptcy law is quite firm on this point. All child support and alimony orders survive a bankruptcy filing 100% intact. These men may escape their credit card debts and outstanding medical bills, and they may slide out from underneath some business debt or drop their car loans if they give up their cars, for example. But they cannot reduce their current or past due child support obligations by a single penny. So we have to think about it. Why do they file? Many of them are in bankruptcy courts to shake off Citibank, Ford Motor Credit, the county hospital bills, and such other unsecured credit. They do this so they can free up the money they need to fulfill their obligations to their children. As Professor Warren says, one congressman and his cronies have charged that these men suffer an absence of personal responsibility. But for many, filing for bankruptcy may be the most responsible thing these divorced fathers can do for their children. Professor Warren continues that the illusion that dads can pay enough to stabilize the broken family is born partly of hope and partly of despair. If dad can't pay more, how does the single mother ever escape the two-income trap? For that matter, how does the divorced father break free? Her response is, they do it the same way the dual-income family does. The predicament of divorced mothers has worsened, not because divorce itself is any harder, but because couples today are in worse shape before they split up. Solutions that improve the financial footing of married couples will help divorcing parents by putting them in a stronger position as they embark on their newly separated lives. So, for example, if decent public schools were made available to all children, regardless of the child's zip code, then the bidding wars for suburban housing would let up and the newly single mother could start off divorced life with a more moderate mortgage. She also might be less reluctant to give up the family home and move into a cheaper house if a school choice policy ensured that she wouldn't be forced to transfer the kids to an unfamiliar and often inferior public school. Similarly, if public-funded preschool were made available to all children, a single mother with young children would have more leeway in her budget. In addition, policies that encourage personal savings and discourage debt would help both spouses survive the economic aftermath of divorce. And I've spoken about these things in prior shows. If a woman started her divorce life with no credit card debt and some money in the bank, she would have a better chance of holding on to her house and staying out of the bankruptcy courts. And if a father left his marriage on more secure financial footing, he would stand a better chance of making his child support payments and keeping himself and his ex-wife out of bankruptcy. Also, policies that expand health insurance and disability coverage would particularly benefit single parents because they are the most vulnerable when disaster strikes. We've discussed these issues in the past, and we will continue expanding on the ideas next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from QLP 100.1 FM, Voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.